From UA Little Rock Public Radio, this is The Art Scene. I'm Daniel Breen. It's been over 70 years since we were first introduced to the story of George Bailey and his guardian angel Clarence. Frank Capra's 1946 masterpiece, It's a Wonderful Life, has become a Christmas staple, even something of a tradition in certain families. Irreverent, heartwarming, and deeply tragic at times, It's a Wonderful Life isn't your typical Christmas movie, but for many, the performances of Jimmy Stewart, Donna Reed, and Lionel Barrymore are emblematic of the holiday season. Now, just in time for the holidays, Arkansans can transport themselves to Bedford Falls for an unforgettable evening. The Arkansas Rep is bringing the story to the stage in the form of a live radio play. Today, we listen back to a panel discussion with some of the people responsible for the Rep staging of It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play. We talk with director Giovanna Sardelli, sound designer and musical arranger Jane Shaw, and actors Mary Murphy and Patrick Halley. The four joined together at the University of Arkansas Clinton School of Public Service to talk about what this adaptation is, how it's different from others, and what it means for the story that's become so familiar over the years. Jane Shaw speaks first.
I'll say what our costume designer said last night, Sarah, who I was trying to figure out how to express that there was some relation between the celebration of the ordinary man, that is George Bailey, that really attracted Jimmy Stewart, maybe you'll tell the story, Jimmy Stewart to the role, that there's a relationship between that and between Foley sound, so the recreation of sound effects, the celebration of a simple sound that we hear every day, and how do we recreate it on stage? And I was trying to figure out how to say that, and our costume designer said, oh, it's like this adaptation is like a love letter to the ordinary. The ordinary man, the ordinary sound, it celebrates that, and that's all of us, too. Crediting Sarah Netfield.
First of all, I should just warn you, I'm Italian and I cry whenever I talk about It's a Wonderful Life for any length of time because I love the story. And I think something that Joe Landry did that was interesting because it drew me into the play but then also forced me to reconcile with it differently in making it a radio play and in distilling the entire community of Bedford Falls into five actors. So when you introduced her as Lana Sherwood, you're actually like 16. You're every woman who appears in Bedford Falls. That's what she voices, all those characters. So in that place where that you start to hear a story you know so well, anew, completely new. And I'm one of those people who every Christmas story actually resonated, like Christmas Carol. I decided I would not grow up to be Scrooge. And in this play right now, I think there's no better question we can be asking ourselves of, do we want to live in Pottersville or do we want to live in Bedford Falls? And part of what I love about this play is exactly that, the celebration of community, the celebration of what matters in this world. And the magical way it transpires in this particular iteration.
My cats growing up were named Clarence and George. So I have been such a fan of this story since 1991, I'd say. I said this, I think, the first week in rehearsal, and I was reminded of it this morning, but I think what is so special about telling this story here is... this is a spoiler, but at the end of the tale, when George is in trouble, the town rallies and they give whatever they can. They give pocket change and coins and they save him. And that was very much the story of Arkansas Rep this past year. And so I think it just makes it that much more special and powerful here.
I would say for me, this has allowed me to have a much deeper appreciation for this story, because it's something, of course, that we all grew up with and knew. But taking another look at it, it's allowed me to go much deeper with understanding how powerful the messages are in it. And you were saying as far as whether or not we want to be in Pottersville, or, you know, these are timeless messages, I guess, you know, revisiting it in this way has, I don't know, brought them to life.
You all raise a bunch of very good points, but I think I want to go with something that you said, Jane, about the role of sound, because I think when I saw the play last night, I think that's something that's probably the first thing that sticks out to you, is the role of sound as sort of the plot, really. And like you mentioned, Mary, that you are numerous women in the play, you're not just playing one specific character. All the actors also sort of have the responsibility of being Foley artists as well. So I guess I'm just wondering, what is the treatment that you do to make the sound part of the plot, and if that differs in any way from what you're normally doing in sound design?
Hi, because we're all sound designers up here, really, for this production.
Sure.
You know, so yes, Mary plays all these roles, but she also plays the door and part of the ice cream story, and is a very good wind on a bicycle wheel, and, you know, I mean, there's lots of, and Patrick really brought to life the car. I think that was a special rehearsal skill. Yeah. So that kind of collaboration is unusual for me. I've done some light Foley before. One time I worked with sort of a person who was, that was all they did, and so they could, you know, they didn't have to also play all these roles and figure out how to switch hats, so that was different. But this was so specific, and when you go back and see the show a second or third time, I mean, the first time I think you are watching the story, but now I've seen it many times. Like, one of my favorite things is to watch the actors when they're not the front focal of the story, and watch them watching each other. There's a supportive, like, real love that you can see as they sit and watch. And sometimes support with sound, but sometimes with small crickets or, you know, are just supporting the other people on stage. And I'm not as aware of that on stage for the audience to see in other productions. I'm used to, you know, I would say in dance, that when I work on dance and I'm aware of dancers in the wings, they have a similar attitude as what you all are displaying on stage. And that seems very special to me.
The interesting choice was to have a very small cast and to have many people playing different characters. I guess, was that intentional? Was that sort of designed to make the show feel smaller, or was it sort of how the show was written itself?
It's how the show is conceived. So Joe did this really interesting thing, knowing that, again, this is kind of America's Christmas story. So when you get the rights to the play, he says the way that it's written is five actors doing the Foley. But he understands community groups will do this, so he says it can be done with one to, you know, 5 to 31 people in the town. Or there, if you go online, there are pictures of kids in the show. We opted to do it with five because I think it's magical. One of the things I admire most about actors, one of the reasons I enjoyed teaching actors for many years and training to be an actor, is the art of transformation. I marvel at how quickly you each become multiple people. And in this way that honors not just a physical representation of a human being, but a spirit and a soul and an attitude of a person. I was last night really appreciating that skill and talent. And so I think it's just another magical aspect of the production and the conceit of it.
And then as actors, is that fun for you, or is it completely exhausting?
It's probably both. Yeah. It was certainly daunting at first, But yeah, it's I think it requires us to be on our toes more than usual. And yet to turn and transform on a dime and transform your spine and your posture and your face and your voice, but to do it in a truthful and genuine way is I think harder. But with the expert hands of our director, it was easy.
And then kind of on a similar line, you notice when you see the show that George Bailey is, I believe he's the only actor who does not play more than one character. And like you said, creating that authenticity, he's not, you know, he's not doing a caricature of Jimmy Stewart because, you know, we can all do that, sure. But it's more of like an homage. But I guess, what does that say about the narrative? Does that mean we need one character to sort of lean on to anchor ourselves in the narrative? Or is that just the way that It's a Wonderful Life is written?
No, I think he's the heart of the story. And so I think it's important that he is one human being. I took him out of the, there are commercials. And I took him out of the commercials because the thought of George Bailey getting up there and selling, you know, hair products kind of crushed my soul. So I really, that was something that let me know that while Joe has created this really fun and lively world, that he was also attentive to the heart of the story and didn't want to make a mockery of what this man is going through. I mean, it's the story of a man who is in such despair he contemplates killing himself on Christmas Eve. And so that is still, by preserving George, you preserve that story and the stakes of the story.
And like you said, you know, at the time, at least in the 40s, it was such a revolutionary film. It was very dark, kind of like an oddball sense of humor, really. It's one of the first things you see in the film. I guess I'm just wondering how that translated into this adaptation of that, which is it was because you are playing actors, playing roles, is that sort of limiting for you, or does that add a whole layer of complexity to it, I guess?
I don't think that it limits you in a way. It kind of gives you a roadmap, and you approach it not as Clarence or as George's father or as George's uncle or George's brother, all of whom I play, and one character who's just called Man and has one line. Yeah, and he's from Chicago, I've chosen. But yeah, it's the character of the old-timey radio performer is kind of a nice home. And then from there, I think it's almost easier to slip into accents and sort of voices.
And I would say, because we're also doing Foley, except for George Bailey, I feel like it's a very, like a complex symphony, and we're all, you know, the different musical sections, and we're supporting the soloist, let's say, you know, I mean, that we're just all constantly different parts.
And that makes a lot of sense because it's sort of the technical aspects like the Foley, mm-hmm. and certain identifiers, you know, the shoes, for one thing, was a big thing that I noticed last night. Those sort of become the identity of the character, even though, you know, you're playing multiple characters, it's sort of like a signal as to when you're shifting into a character. But I guess it almost becomes an extension of the character or synonymous with them. I'm just wondering, specifically from the technical aspect, is that different when you're choosing props or choosing how to have actors use props, or is that normally the process?
I just want to call out a local, Linda Qualick, who is the props designer on the piece, and who worked with us. We had early conversations with, say, another name, Joe Winiarski, who did the set, beautiful set, and we sort of talked through all the sound, but then all the props. And Linda always kept her eye on making it fit the 1940s world, you know, and she really, I think she was a real help in that. And that's true, you know, like, I often run into this actually in shows where you're trying to do, you don't want something to be anachronistic because then we don't want the audience to suddenly be thinking, why is that now I'm in the 1960s, but I thought the play was in the 1940s, and now you're not thinking about the story. So, but she was someone who kept us honest, I felt, about that.
And she was wonderful. You know, we would say there's a squeak, a particular squeak in the play that we need. And she, I think she brought in like 7 squeaking household items so that we could hear each one, look at it. The actor who manipulates that particular sound could play with it. And it releases the inner child in everybody. Like just to play. And we all did this when we were growing up. So that's the attention to the look of it, the feel of it, the sound of it. I mean, we're counting jelly beans. You know, how many does it take to make the sound of this? It's been utterly fascinating to work on the play and hear a story with such specificity.
I'm just curious, which of the 7 squeaking objects did you finally settle on? What was that process?
The cheese grater. It has a particular brand name. It was all the talk in the ladies' room last night. Everyone wanted to know about the cheese, about the squeak. And now I forgot the name of the product, but it's, it's the cheese grater that it's round and it cranks this way and leaves the little piece of cheese in the middle. Yeah, I don't know what it's called.
And it steals the show. The cheese grater.
If you're just joining us, we're listening back to a panel discussion at Little Rock's Clinton School of Public Service about Arkansas Rep's production of It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play. We're speaking with director Giovanna Sardelli, sound designer and arranger Jane Shaw, and actors Mary Murphy and Patrick Halley.
Who is the audience for this show? Because it is, on one hand, you have this sort of film that's been lionized, that's become a Christmas tradition in many respects. And then, of course, in the other aspect, you are telling it through the device of radio, essentially. I'm just wondering how that colors your perception of who the audience is.
Everyone.
Yeah.
Honestly, I mean, I've seen the story a million times, and last night I watched it like a child, laughing, crying. It is such a beautiful story, and it's so inventive in the way it's being told that even if you've seen it, you haven't seen it like this. But we had a conversation one day when we realized we're not actually doing it for those people who have seen it 20 times. We're doing it so that you can bring your kids and your grandkids, and that we wanted to make sure we weren't just regurgitating a story everyone knows, but telling a story as if it had never been told before, to introduce it to people for whom it's new. So we really were attentive, I think, in that. And yesterday there were young girls in the audience, and it was amazing to watch. Today I'm going to sit so I can see whoever's the youngest person in the audience see the show. That's what I'll be watching.
I don't know if there's a question here, but because I've seen the movie so many times and, you know, it's grown up with it essentially, when I was watching it, it made me think, you know, for people who are like me, who are very familiar with the story, is this really a way of sort of teaching them to make meaning in a new way, that sound is part of the plot, the characters are all the same person? Is there just sort of a way that this can be applied to any story, really? Or do you think maybe it has to be specific to something that feels right for the period? Maybe that could have been on the radio?
Yeah, I mean, I think the radio style can lend itself to almost anything. I guess part of the fun in this is to dive into that time frame and, you know, just the costumes from that era were so great. But yeah, I mean, I think this could work with almost anything. I think perhaps why it works so well with this is because it's so iconic and it's so well known that to jump into it through this fresh lens, it allows you to, I think, really connect to the core and the themes and the morality. And if you strip away big scene changes and all kinds of sets, you can wrap your head around the simplicity of it, which with a film that many of us have seen 25 times, is a gift, I think.
going back to the sound, because of course, when you're in the rehearsal process, because you're actors, but you're also sound designers, like you said, is that, I guess, are you being directed sort of the same way that you're learning your lines? Are you learning cues for Foley, or is it a different process for you all?
Well, we had Jane here. she gave us all of this, all these tutorials on how to work the Foley. So we had a couple of rehearsal days that we devoted to working specifically with the sound. And then I would say it was a question of incorporating it into the rest of the scenes and letting it be part of your character, of supporting whatever was happening in the story at that time.
And we were so blessed. Jane came in and was with us right from the start, mm-hmm. which is not normally how this sort of process would work. So we as a cast were able to learn and establish our vocabulary of sound first. And I think that helped us to really sketch out the story in a complete way.
The question I really want to ask is, Jane, did you ever just listen to the play? Did you ever just like close your eyes and not see what was happening?
Yes, definitely. And actually in previews, I've been more aware of myself just like closing my eyes and listening to certain sequences. Because sometimes there's a lot going on, you know, and I'm you know, does that mic come up in the right time? Oh my God, you know what I mean? So yes, definitely closing my eyes and listening has been more a part of the process. I'm always listening, but I think, yeah, because also it's about living in the same sort of sonic plane more than I'm used to, that the voices, like, say the ice cream scene, which these two perform together. It's like an interplay with the language, and it's one of those that we've kind of gone back and made clearer and clearer. And when it's really working, you see this relationship between the young George and the young Mary come together as he serves her ice cream. But that's only clear if the scoop of the ice cream is between the lines, and his joy in giving her three scoops is clear rather than just like a lot of sound altogether. So yeah, I have been, you know, more listening, I guess, in that way. Yeah,
we had one of the longest meetings I've ever had. It was it did go fast. We could not believe how much time had passed, because I've never directed like this. I'm a very playful director. I love for actors to play and discover. And right before we started rehearsal, Jane and I realized, oh, we can't do it like this. So we sat in a Le Pan Quotidien and marked out where every piece of sound had to live, which actor would do it. Was there a reason that actor was doing it, or was it simply location? So the entire show was pre-blocked, walking in the door, which is something I don't do, but it was fun because it let the last week be really playful within the form, which is also true for the story, the form of the radio show.
Mary and Patrick, I know, Mary, you have voiceover experience. I don't know too much about it, but I know it's voice acting is different than stage acting. But, you know, obviously you both have experience in both of them. I'm just wondering how that is different in a play that is for the radio, when you're supposed to be voice acting, but you have to remember that you're on the stage.
And I would think that what has helped this not just be about the voice has been that it's staged. It's that Giovanna has fleshed it out in a way that we're not just doing a concert version where we're at a music stand. We are able to embody the characters, and that makes it more, it bridges it over into stage. But yes, because it's easy to, you could just stay in the voice land without doing that, but I think the way that this has been approached has helped that shift.
We were encouraged to, I think the term you used was to really treat the language almost as a waltz. And if I'm describing a scene as Clarence filled with joy and awe, is it amazing or is it amazing? And it's just a way to pack each of these words with description and sound and reaction.
Before I do let you guys go, I do want to just ask, what are your individual experiences with It's a Wonderful Life? Did you grow up watching it? Had you never seen it before this? Did you enjoy it? Did you think it was corny? What did it mean to you in your life?
I'll be honest, when I was a kid, I don't really think I appreciated the movie. It wasn't until I was an adult. And also, after my father passed away, I worked on a concert abridged version of it. And it was just a one-shot, like, you know, staged reading. Going through that experience, I had a shift in my whole perspective of the story, and I really had a much deeper appreciation of it. When I was growing up, it wasn't something that I paid much attention to.
I told you about my cats. I watch it every single year. There's a art house movie theater in Lower Manhattan which shows it on a huge screen, and I would always go and cry every single time. Every single time, a public, ugly cry.
At Christmas time when my family was to go to Texas to visit my grandparents, and the only time that football wasn't on the TV was when my grandfather would let my grandmother watch this movie. But I didn't really, and I so regret it. Like, it really took this experience for me to go and really sit down and watch it and enjoy it. And I found it so moving, and as a child, I just remember that that was grandmother's film and that I would watch it. And so, yeah, I'd seen, why is there a raven? And then, you know, I'd left. And I sort of hadn't. And I so wish that I had taken the time to sit with her and watch it, because I think it meant a lot to her.
I love the story. And it's interesting, like, the hallmarks of our life, where the movie has come to mean something different. You know, it was interesting, one of the people in the audience said, this is the first time I've seen this play or heard the story since I've become a parent. And the entire story was hitting her differently. The place, she said, I cried in all the new places. It was the movie that I watched when I was doing 27 other things. So I thought I knew it. And then when I was hired to direct this and went back and sat there and watched the movie, so exactly, I was like, where are all these animals in Uncle Billy's office? All these things that I had not seen. So really diving back into that story, and a cry every time. So I have always loved it, but this year was particularly special to dive back into it.
That was Giovanna Sardelli, director of Arkansas Rep's production of It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play. She spoke alongside sound designer and arranger Jane Shaw and actors Mary Murphy and Patrick Halley as part of a panel discussion at the University of Arkansas Clinton School of Public Service. The show runs until December 29th.
And that concludes the program for this week. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UA Little Rock Public Radio.